Whistleblower Report, exposing lies, deceptions, and all that has assaulted our way of life. We must take back our freedom and live as God designed in a free America that honors our Constitution and our Creator. Our experts in medicine, ministry, law, military, environment, and education empower us to grow together as a nation. For such a time as this, the Whistleblower Report offers truth and solutions. Welcome to the Whistleblower Report. This is Dr. Lee for America with the Truth for Health Foundation Whistleblower Report. And tonight we want to be talking about the way in which the COVID death protocols were implemented and escalated under the Biden administration in 2021, leading to not only deaths in our hospitals, but deaths from the COVID shots, which were mandated only under the Biden administration. There had been no COVID injection mandates under the Trump administration, and there were none planned for a second Trump administration. When the election was stolen in 2020, these are the consequences that come when election integrity is not maintained, fraud is not investigated, and stolen elections are allowed to stand. This is the story of one woman's crusade to stop the deaths and expose what was happening. And you'll hear the tragic story leading to her reasons and how she took action to help stop the COVID death protocols, both on the injections and on the hospital protocols. And I want to be clear, remdesivir was known to be a toxic drug during the Ebola trials when it had to be stopped for the fact that the Safety Oversight Committee recognized that of the four drugs in the earlier Ebola trials about 10 years ago, remdesivir killed 53% of the patients, not Ebola. It was the drug, because the other three drugs in the clinical trials did not have that high death rate. So come 2020, Anthony Fauci knew that remdesivir was a toxic and dangerous drug, and he proclaimed it to be the gold standard for COVID, whether it was dangerous or not. But the damage, the extensive damage from remdesivir and the rest of the hospital death protocol, which included overuse and overdosing of midazolam, fentanyl, and morphine, along with withholding antibiotics, diabetes drugs, and other standard treatments for other medical conditions, withholding fluid, withholding nutrition, jacking up the oxygen flow rates to the point of causing oxygen toxicity damage to the lung. Any hyperbaric medicine specialist knows that oxygen can be toxic to the lungs in high doses at high pressures. Any scuba diver who dove enriched air nitrogen, as I did for many years, nitrox divers know that oxygen toxicity increases with time, depth, and pressure. So oxygen toxicity on the lungs is well known in medicine. And what was happening in the hospitals was the combination of all of these things, even when patients had kidney disease, even when patients had underlying pulmonary disease, which they did with COVID, but even those who had pulmonary disease before COVID were being treated with drugs known to be toxic to people with pulmonary and kidney disease in particular. So keep that in mind. The escalation of these COVID death protocols did not occur until 2021. And we saw it in our work with Truth for Health Foundation, hospital rescues, trying to stop the death protocols, trying to rescue people. We saw it really skyrocket in the summer of 2021, around June, July, August, which was also the same time that the Biden administration put in the COVID mandates for the military, for all military to get the COVID injections, even though they were experimental. They had the right to refuse, and all of the religious exemptions were pretty much denied across all branches of service until there were enough court actions and injunctions to stop that practice. So let's lay the fault where it belongs, right squarely at the feet of the Biden administration and the shadow government of the Obama administrative team who was in place for 8 years under Obama and put forward the health information technology, required electronic medical records, Obamacare, and rationing of care for older people. All of those provisions that were put in place by Ezekiel Emanuel as the health policy czar under President Obama were the basis for the COVID death protocols that, wait for it, Ezekiel Emanuel, now health policy COVID advisor in the shadows for the Biden administration, put in place under the Biden administration. So I wanted to connect those dots for you in the big picture so that you understood the progression of how all of these things were put in place long before COVID and how they were weaponized during COVID and targeting elderly, disabled people, elderly people, unvaccinated people, and particularly minorities and Caucasians. It was quite a staggering unfolding of the death protocols that I warned about in editorials during the Obama administration, that this was what was coming. And this is what unfolded under the guise of COVID protocol in the Biden administration in 2021 and has continued to this very day. Our guest today, along with my co-host, Major Mike Gary, military Seaburn officer with 25 years in the U.S. military and 15 years as a chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapons officer, Seaburn. Major Gary is joining us because he has seen the consequences of these toxic approaches to patients, and bioweapons are his training. And our special guest is Leslie Batts, who is formerly of Oklahoma and now in Florida. And she is a COVID death protocol widow and also a medical freedom activist. Leslie, welcome to the show today. And I really want to ask you to tell our audience first about the event that you organized in Oklahoma just recently on all of these COVID death protocols with the vaccine and the hospital drugs being misused and overused, including remdesivir, midazolam, morphine, and fentanyl. And then we'll talk about the horrible tragedy that you went through. So welcome to the show. And I want to thank Major Gary for introducing me to you to have a chance to have us to have this discussion to educate others.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. And it's an honor to speak with you both. On February 17th, we held an event at the Oklahoma State Capitol to try to bring awareness to what is happening under the guise of COVID. Unfortunately, it's just that, it's a guise. It's a ruse. So much has been blamed on COVID that has come from other places. So we had doctors that had actually been victims themselves in the hospital of the protocols. We had a lovely husband and wife who lost their daughter to the vaccine mandate at 19 years old because she wanted to go to college. We had a civil rights attorney that spoke. We had a gentleman who lost his daughter to the protocol, and she was 19. So we had actual eyewitnesses to what had occurred. We were fortunate enough that some of the representatives had come and were willing to hear the truth of what was happening. And we were pretty effective as far as getting the word out. We had some local news coverage, but the point of our event was to introduce our petition that we're going to be filing with the Attorney General so that we can open an investigation or convene a grand jury to open an investigation to look into the crimes that were actually committed inside the hospitals. Without speculation, we have evidence in the medical records of false imprisonment, people being sedated and physically restrained so that they can't exercise their right to leave the hospital. We have evidence of battery, patients being forced into procedures and treatments that they had refused. We have evidence of fraud. Authorization forms being forged for treatments. And because of the PREP Act and the doctors and hospitals and manufacturers all being granted immunity from civil liability, we were looking for an avenue that we could break through the guise of COVID, because what we found is very little of what happened in the hospital actually related to COVID. The remdesivir was a horrible drug and it did tremendous amounts of damage. I believe, in my opinion, that it was the ball that started the process rolling to get people onto the ventilators so that they could get those incentives. The hospital that my husband was at had received over $60 million in COVID relief funds for patients who had died.
$60 million.
$60 million.
Let that sink in, America. Our government has been paying our hospitals to kill us.
Yes, ma'am. And every step of the way, there's an incentivization. The PCR test with an admission received an incentive. The ventilator received an incentive. The death certificate receives an incentive. And then you get the 20% add-on bonus if they follow the protocol to a T. So all it takes is a faulty PCR test to start the whole thing, and it's a death sentence. The moment that test comes back positive on in a hospital, you're started down a path that you can't return from. And what we found when we started filing complaints, I've been to the health department, I have been to the medical board, I have been to the nursing board, I have been to the police department, I've been to CMS to file complaints against conditions of participation, because those are federal regulations. And the first thing everyone would tell me was, it's a civil matter, go get a lawyer. Well, a lawyer won't touch it because it said COVID on his death certificate. And then I went to the legislators and asked for help from the legislators. And for a year, year and a half, they literally ran me around in circles. Well, we have laws against that. I said, okay, so what's the enforcement for those laws? What is our mechanism of enforcement when the No Patient Left Alone Act is violated? And as it turns out, the last line of the law states it's against, that there is no agency that has any authority to enforce the law. And I looked at the author of the bill and I said, you do realize you made it against the law to enforce the law, written right into the law. And it was unfortunate how no one seemed to understand that there, by the grace of God, go you or I, that these patients that were literally prisoners in the hospital could have been any one of us. It could have been their children. It could have been their wife. It could have been their mother or their father. And they didn't seem to recognize that. They seemed to feel like they were immune. But there's over 1 million people in this country that died, and over 20,000 in the state of Oklahoma. So when we started looking at, well, what avenues do we have? I started researching the laws to find out how we can break through that barrier of justice, because the system was not working for us, it was working against us. And what I found was that under the federal rules of criminal procedure, rule number 6, if it is established as a matter of public interest, that the attorney general is compelled to convene a grand jury. And in the state of Oklahoma, under the Constitution, it states that the attorney general, when it is a matter of public concern, is compelled to convene a grand jury. So our thinking was that if we can get it in front of a grand jury of people just like you and I, that perhaps someone there had lost a loved one and they had called it COVID. Maybe, just maybe, they had questions about what had happened to their loved one. And that's kind of what our thinking was that led us to the event at the Capitol. We've made contact. I say we. I work with a wonderful woman named Peggy Hokett, also out in Oklahoma. And we've heard hundreds of stories from widows that all seem to follow the same script. They come into the hospital. In the emergency room, they're treated pretty standard as far as medical treatment is concerned. And then they get admitted or transferred to another hospital to be admitted. And the moment they come in the door, as you stated, the hyperoxygenation begins the process of decompensation and decline. And within 24 to 48 hours, they've gone from a nasal cannula or high flow nasal cannula airvo to a BiPAP mask, which is forcing air into their lungs now at that high rate. And within another 24 to 48 hours after the BiPAP, generally they're forced onto a ventilator. And we couldn't stand by and not say something. I have a child that I have to protect at this point. I have friends and family and neighbors that this could happen to them. My biggest fear is that my son plays football and he gets a broken arm. I have to take him to the emergency room and they've mandated PCR tests in the emergency room.
My understanding is that that is no longer being done. Now, you can refuse it. Every patient has the right to refuse it. You also have the right to walk out of that emergency room if they are trying to push it and go to a different facility. I mean, unless it's a life-threatening, hemorrhaging, blood loss, critical trauma situation, you do have the right to refuse that. And you're right. Something like people don't realize that patients have a lot more power than they think they do, and then that the authorities try to convince them. And one of our roles in Truth for Health Foundation, and one of the reasons we were fighting so hard in the trenches on the hospital rescues throughout the 2021, 2022, there was less of that that we were directly involved in 2023, because by that time, more patients and families had become a lot more aware of what was going on and were much more proactive. But a lot of our work is focused on teaching patients what their rights are again, since they've been conditioned to think the government decides everything and the insurance companies decide everything. Major Gary, you've seen some of this as well. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Lee. And there was a lady in our church that the congregation kind of brought to my attention. And she had a similar situation to Leslie. I think her husband actually, he was on Vax. So he got remdesivir early. This is where I discovered in Maine that there was two protocols. And this would be the fall of 2021, that if you are unvaxxed, you got the remdesivir earlier in the protocols, like step two or so.
And, which was a Biden administration directive.
Correct. Yeah. And so it's just amazing from Oklahoma to Maine how cold people are, how heartless they are. I mean, that staff that's worked all those people, you know, through the protocols, you know, the nurses and doctors that got them through the protocols, how can they live with themselves? They did not, for the doctors, they didn't hold up their oaths to do no harm. It just blows my mind. This is why, like Leslie was saying earlier, she couldn't get anybody to act, whether it was law enforcement or the legal side with lawyers, attorneys, and stuff like that. It was just, it's something we've never seen before, but the other agencies like law enforcement wouldn't even look into it. They wouldn't even hear your story, like Leslie's story. So it's just crazy how cold people have become. We're talking about transhumanism a lot now. Well, in a way, it's almost here because people are almost emotionless. They almost have no ability to care for others.
So you know, Mike, Major Gary, I think I.
We live in a world full of disinformation, lies, and deceit, often from those institutions and individuals that we used to rely on and trust. In the chaos that surrounds us on a daily basis, it's difficult to find a place for truthful information and helpful guidance. Where can we turn for honest answers, critical solutions, and information that empowers us to be the person that God intended? The Truth for Health Foundation. The Truth for Health Foundation works every day to fight for your basic human rights. We have a track record of providing life-saving emergency actions that can improve your health and empower you with the tools to be safe, happy, and free to live your life. With over 100,000 supporters around the world, we are a critical voice of truth in today's world. We invite you to join our community of financial supporters so that we can continue to be your trusted partner for health, for life, for resilience. Join us today by giving now.
Hello, everyone. This is Lieutenant Mark Bashaw, U.S. Army and legal grant recipient of the Truth for Health Foundation. I want to give a huge shout out to the Truth for Health Foundation for helping me and my family over the past year with our legal battles. Recently, I was court-martialed for not participating with these experimental COVID-19 emergency use authorized products. If it wasn't for Truth for Health Foundation and all the support, I would definitely be in a worse spot. But because of all the support, I'm able to continue uniform service, fighting for what's right to protect the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. God bless each and every one of you, and God bless America.
Major Gary, I think that actually it's here. Transhumanism is here. Cutting off the connection between God and the individual human is the goal of transhumanism, and changing God's design of human beings. It's Satan's attack on God's design. And I think that's here. We're seeing it play out in the coldness and callousness of the hospital treatment of patients, the staff, doctors and nurses. Hospitals used to be a trusted institution. They are no longer. And we're seeing it there, but we're also seeing it in churches that have been corrupted by government payments, and they are acting contrary to biblical teachings. They're acting contrary to the best interest of their parishioners' physical, emotional, and spiritual health. And we're seeing it in the weaponization of our agencies. And I think the COVID death protocol is one part of the bigger picture. And you see it in the feral quality of the behavior, the brutal beatings, on school buses, I mean, on our streets, the brutality of the violence, the barbaric aspect. Recent Colorado co-ed who tragically, an illegal invader, entered the dorm in Boulder, Colorado, and brutally raped and tortured this young co-ed and then dismembered her. This is not the kind of violence that we've ever seen on a broad scale in America, and it's happening every day. And I think this assault on our civil society has escalated in very dire ways under the Biden administration. And I think the playing out of the transhumanism agenda and just the barbaric nature of the violence has truly been alarming. And it surprises me that more people are not outraged over that and taking action, as Leslie courageously did. So I agree with your statement. I just think it's not nearly here. I think it is here. And we're seeing it play out every day. Let's take a break, and we'll be right back with more of the Whistleblower Report and more of the personal tragedy that hit Leslie and her family under the Biden administration's bounty on your life. That was the title of one of our early press conferences on the COVID death protocol. But this was the Biden administration putting bounties on people's lives and pushing the COVID death protocol through financial incentives. Another way of looking at it is murder for hire. This is Dr. Lee for America. We'll be right back after the break. Check out our website, truthforhealth.org, and check out our store, truthforhealthstore.com, where you'll find high-quality, professional-exclusive formulas of nutraceuticals and support for your health and resilience, products that are manufactured in the United States under certified good manufacturing practices with a plant inspected, actually by the FDA, better inspections for the nutraceutical manufacturer that we have contracted with than what has been done for the pharma manufacturers of the COVID shots. So if you're questioning whether you can trust big pharma, at least look to our nutraceuticals and our products that can help keep you healthy, so you need less of the big pharma products. We'll be right back after the break. Welcome to the second half of the Whistleblower Report. This is Dr. Lee for America with Major Mike Gary, my co-host, and our special guest, Leslie Batts, who is really a courageous freedom fighter and activist for truth, coming out of her own personal tragedy. Leslie, if you would share with our listeners what happened when your husband went into the hospital in Oklahoma and how that motivated you for all that you've done since.
Yes, ma'am.
And my sincere condolences on your husband's death. It is so egregiously wrong because it's preventable and they knew what they were doing with these protocols. And it just makes it so horrific. I just really feel for you in your loss.
Thank you so much. My husband had worked out of town, and when he came back, he started showing symptoms of being sick. We thought it was the flu. But after he was required to test for work, he was never vaccinated. Neither was my son or myself. But he was required to test for work because his coworker that he had been with tested positive. And he stayed home and progressed, you know, like he would with the flu, feverish, achy, tired. And the biggest mistake I think I made was I went and purchased a pulse oximeter. I had taken care of my mother for several years when she was in respiratory failure, so I was familiar with COPD and oxygenation and that type of thing. So I started on Friday checking his pulse ox, and he was in the mid-80s. So I started calling around trying to get oxygen at home for him and a prescription for a nebulizer with some albuterol or budesonide, something for a breathing treatment. He didn't seem to be short of breath really at that point. He was coughing a little bit. But with the pulse ox being so low, I figured it probably wouldn't hurt. So for 2 days, I tried to get some oxygen at home. And of course, it was over the weekend, so I couldn't get anyone to respond. And I ended up having to take him into the emergency room that evening on Saturday because he started dropping into the 70s. And I knew it. And once you start getting into the 70s, there's complications. You're looking at cellular damage being done, I guess, at that point. And tissue, lack of oxygen issues. So we got to the emergency room. I was not allowed to go inside. And the last thing he said to me before he got out of the car was, "Do not let them put me on a vent." And I said, "You got it, honey. I love you." And he walked in. A couple of hours later, I get a phone call from, I'm sitting in the parking lot waiting for him. I get a phone call from the nurse saying that they're going to transfer him to a level 3 ICU in Tulsa. This was in Cushing where we started out. And it didn't make any sense to me because he's texting me and he's, you know, his sats are back up into the 90s, you know, 96, I think he was at. He was feeling good. He was ready to come home. But they were going to transfer him.
I can't believe that someone with sats of 96% O2 is being pushed to be transferred to an ICU. That's outrageous.
Yes, ma'am. And that was on the 10 liters a minute of oxygen. He was transferred. I assumed they were going to take him by ambulance, and I was wrong. They said that they couldn't transfer him by ambulance because it was an hour drive, and if he decompensated, that they couldn't intubate him. In the ambulance, I said, "Well, you won't intubate him. He's already stated he did not want to be ventilated." And so they life-flighted him by helicopter. And they maintained the 10 liters of oxygen in transport and Everything said there was no labored breathing. He was in no acute distress. And even when he got out in the 70s, he wasn't cyanotic. He wasn't showing any symptoms of low oxygen. It was simply the number on that monitor. And so I immediately called the emergency room in Tulsa and told them he is a DNI. Do not intubate. They said, absolutely, we'll mark it on the chart. Apparently, that never happened. Immediately on his admission, they put him on 60 liters a minute of oxygen, which again, I speculate, I'm not a doctor. You would certainly know better than I, but I'm familiar with what happens with oxygen toxicity and that it causes shortness of breath and it causes coughing and it causes all of the symptoms that they say are COVID. He was doing well, even on the 60 liters. Throughout the 10th of October into the morning of the 11th, they started administering Precedex. Now, Precedex, I'm sure you're familiar, is used for intubation. That's the purpose of the drug, and it's not supposed to be administered for more than 24 hours because it causes cardiac side effects.
And
So,
Precedex sedates the person so that
yes.
they are not capable of really advocating for themselves any longer.
Correct. And the last text message I received from him on the 11th was, they won't stop asking me about intubation, and I'm starting to lose my cool. At that point in the medical records, they started to increase the sedation level and cut off all communications between the two of us. He apparently had no idea he was being sedated because what I found out later was his IV pump was outside of his room around the corner of the wall, so he couldn't see what was being administered. And
You know, this just sounds absolutely horrific and such a violation of the standard of care that we've always practiced.
yes, ma'am. Absolutely. So I didn't hear from him again. I was trying to call him. He wasn't answering. I'd call the nurses. They'd say, no, he's just refusing to talk to you. He's watching TV and eating his dinner. He just doesn't want to talk to you. And around noon the next day, actually, I guess it was closer to 1 o'clock the next day, I received a phone call from the doctor saying that my husband had given consent to intubation, and I called him a liar. I told him I didn't believe him, that I wanted to hear it from my husband because I hadn't spoken with him in 24 hours. And again, no one's telling me he's been being sedated. So I call my husband's phone, and on video, I'm not sure who answers it. I see my husband. He's got a BiPAP mask on, so I can't understand anything. He seems disoriented, and it appears that his hands have been tied, he's in restraints. Because he's clearly not holding the phone. The video that call lasts for 31 seconds and then we're disconnected. At that point, the doctor calls me back and says, do I have your consent? I said, well, if he's given you consent, first of all, legally, you don't need mine. And second of all, there will be a signed consent form on that chart, correct? And he says, well, I just want to get your consent as well. I said, no, I refuse. What I found out in the medical records was 2 minutes after that phone call, they administered a paralytic and put my husband into respiratory arrest. He was at a 91% oxygen saturation prior to the paralytic being administered.
Oh my Lord. I just am aghast. I've seen some pretty awful things happening in the hospital cases we were involved in with my team and the medical records we saw, but this looks like intentional murder.
Oh, it is. I believe it is.
Major Gary, you have any comments?
I'd
You
like
look
to
as
say,
shocked as I am.
this is pretty creepy how premeditated this was. I think that's the proper term because it shows that they had a plan and courses of action how they were gonna do away with people. For example, hiding the IV bag and the other instruments where he couldn't see them, and then finally getting him wearing him out to a point where he didn't know what was going on. And that's about the same way that I saw it with this lady I was speaking about earlier from my church. So I mean, it's almost standard across the board. They all had slightly different method or courses of action they went to do away with people's loved ones. I just think it's so cold. I can't help but get off that word. Our society has been so cold to each other. And again, it is surprising. Leslie's story is definitely, they went through a lot of steps to get him where they wanted him.
They absolutely did.
Let's see,
But
were
Leslie,
the, have you found any legal actions possible?
no. I received his medical records January 11th was when I got the first set of records, and I got a very small portion. And at that point, when I did not find the consent form on the chart, that's the only reason I got his medical records. Was because he told me he had given consent and I wanted to see that consent form. And it wasn't on the file. But I realized I didn't get all of the medical records at that point. They gave me 537 pages. He was only in the hospital 10 days. It only took them 10 days to kill him. And as I was looking through the medical records, I started realizing I didn't have everything. And it took me months and months and months to get everything. But I immediately started calling attorneys because I knew that there was no consent form. And that's battery, any way you slice it. And because it said COVID on his death certificate, not a single attorney would speak to me.
I wonder how they got to all the attorneys.
The immunity. The PREP Act had them all believing that there was no way they could win a civil litigation, and to fight it was just going to be expensive. And attorneys don't like spending money that they're not going to get back. Unfortunately, there was two other instances that occurred. Interestingly enough, I was told that when all of this occurred and he sent me the text message that they wouldn't stop asking him about intubation, I contacted the hospital administrator, I contacted the patient advocate, and I told them I was coming to get my husband. And they said, if you come to this hospital, you will be arrested. And I had a child at home. I couldn't go to jail. There was no one to take care of him.
We saw
But
that happening in a lot of the cases we were involved with, where family members were taken off the hospital grounds under color of law by police or deputy sheriffs. It
yes.
never happened in my lifetime in this country and my career in medicine.
No, and he was intubated on the 12th, and on the 14th, because I was still raising such a ruckus, I was causing problems for them. The doctor agreed to let me come to the hospital and see my husband after he was intubated. I did go visit, and the first thing that I noticed was that he looked like he'd been in a bar fight. There were bruises and cuts and abrasions all over his face. And I asked what had happened. And they said, well, intubation can be a very violent procedure. I said, no, it really isn't. I watched my
No, it
mother.
isn't.
No, I,
No.
my mother had been intubated a dozen times, and I never saw her with huge bruises on her face and laceration. I mean, literally, the skin on his nose was hanging off. It looked like he'd been in a bar fight. I think he literally was fighting for his life. And
Oh my gosh.
so
I can't even comprehend that this level of evil attacks on vulnerable patients is occurring in the United States of America.
well, and one of the things that occurred to me is all of this was after the vaccines mandate started, as you were speaking, Biden's vaccine mandates, and the hospitals started mandating all of their staff to be vaccinated. So I think what they effectively did was anyone who would dissent the narrative or the
They
if
fired
you're
them.
yeah, well, they fired them. So there was no one left in the hospital to treat patients other than the people that really did believe if you're unvaccinated, you wanted to kill your grandmother. You didn't deserve to live.
I think you're right, Leslie. We certainly saw that, and I've had too many personal stories from patients who've had that happen to family members. I think there is still the risk if you go into a hospital and you're unvaccinated that you will get punitive and persecutory treatment.
I absolutely agree. And I think that's where a lot of the anger from the staff came from, because he wasn't vaccinated and they saw him as less of a person. I
Right.
mean, completely dehumanized.
Yeah, it's like the conscience left these institutions, like the hospitals, the military, and other places. When all these good people got fired and pushed out, the conscience of those institutions had left. So there was nothing holding them back. They were just going to follow orders and do the protocols. And then when this protocol didn't work, they were going to switch over to this course of action protocol and hide things and be deceitful on what's actually going on with the loved ones.
Absolutely. And the other thing you have to keep in mind is at this point, they were pushing the vaccine so hard and they wanted people to take it that, and they weren't getting the compliance that they were hoping for. So they needed a body count. They needed to push that fear that this was a deadly virus. I believe my
You're
husband.
exactly right. The actual virus was the weapon of fear.
Yes. So they created a
Because
body
what,
count.
Leslie, what I found was that this was a very treatable coronavirus illness. If you caught it in the first 3 to 5 days, all the patients I treated in 2020 and 2021 and 2022 and 2023 caught it early, started the combination medications, hydroxychloroquine, antibiotic, maybe ivermectin, budesonide, nebulizer, albuterol inhaler, nutraceuticals, and for those who needed it, home oxygen concentrator. I didn't have any patients go in the hospital, and I didn't have any patients die because early treatment with combination therapy got people through it. It
Absolutely.
was a very treatable illness. I even had people that had a lot of comorbidities, like diabetes, for example, and asthma, that really were significant comorbidities. But with aggressive early treatment, we got them through it.
Absolutely. And we had actually gotten started on the azithromycin and the ivermectin and the vitamins, but I think it was later in the game. I don't think we did enough. I think we did too little too late. And
Well,
because
and you may not have had a home oxygen concentrator either.
no, we didn't have oxygen at home. I tried for a couple of days to get oxygen at home and was unsuccessful. But I think the point at which they had decided that they were going to put an end to all of it was on the 16th, he woke up and he extubated himself. He pulled the tube out. And I apologize, this part is very difficult to speak about. They reparalyzed him and they reintubated him. And the doctor ordered a sedation goal of a RASS negative five. And the pharmacist colluded and removed all of the dosing instructions for the medications, the fentanyl, the midazolam, the propofol, the Nimbex, Precedex,
Wow.
and they gave him max dosages of the fentanyl. He was at 250 micrograms an hour. Precedex, they restarted the Precedex at the maximum dose of 1.5 micrograms per kilogram. Midazolam, he was at 25 milligrams an hour. Propofol was ridiculous. I mean, they just hit him with everything at once, and within a few hours, his brain, his BIS, bispectral index, or brain activity, was registering at zero. And I believe that the doctor intentionally ordered an overdose on my husband. It didn't remain at zero. He started to get some brain activity back, and it was extremely erratic. So I'm sure at that point there was a brain injury that had occurred. And the next day, on the 17th, the doctor tried to coerce me to make him a do not resuscitate. And I refused. The 16th was the one day that I couldn't come visit him because I didn't have anyone to watch my son. And he died on the 20th. And it devastated our family. I grieve for my husband, but I'm angry for my son that now, after the overdose, he passed away on October 20th. So they had effectively killed him in 10 days. He was no comorbidities. The 2 weeks prior to getting sick, he was actually outrunning 12-year-olds on the football field because he was a football coach for my son's little league team.
Oh my heavens.
He
How
was very
old
healthy.
was your husband, Leslie?
45 years old.
45, football coach, active in his community, and they killed him.
Yes, ma'am.
It's just staggering. I mean, I'm listening to what you're saying as a physician, and I find it absolutely horrifying that members of my profession could do intentionally overdose someone who was that age and fit and no comorbidities and contributing so much to his community. I just find this absolutely a horrific crime against humanity when doctors violate their oath to this degree and take those steps, because all of these dosing guidelines are well established, and you normally don't give narcotics to someone with respiratory compromise because it depresses respiration further. I mean, this whole protocol was not what we normally did for respiratory illness.
No, ma'am. And in fact, I have a letter that a doctor who reviewed my husband's records wrote to the Attorney General on my behalf, stating that based on the clinical evidence, and he's just literally just referring to the orders that were placed and the lab work that resulted, that it was premeditated murder. He's made that statement, in a letter to the Attorney General on my behalf. So,
Leslie, if you can send me that letter, we do work with attorneys that may find a way around the obstacles you've encountered. And there may be another avenue that we could help you explore legally.
that would be wonderful. I would greatly appreciate that.
Particularly if you have a letter from a doctor who was stating that in writing to the Attorney General of Oklahoma, I would definitely like to help you find a way to see if there's any legal solution that we could come up with to take action on this. This is just beyond the pale. This is, to me, carrying on the premeditated murder of people during the Nazi Holocaust.
It absolutely is. And that's why I say it's the guise of COVID, because nothing that was done actually treated a respiratory illness.
Right.
It was shocking to see the medical records and to find out that my husband literally endured a nightmare. He was tortured.
It really sounds like it.
Well, that was one of the reasons why he said, do not let them put me on a vent, because if I'm going to die, I'd rather just die. We knew that people weren't coming off ventilators. He said, I'd much rather go peacefully than to end up surviving indefinitely on artificial life support. He was just, that's who he was.
No, he wanted to do
everything on his own terms.
I absolutely understand. This is such a egregious tragedy. And my heart goes out to you and your family.
Thank you.
And yeah, I really hope we can do something that will help find some way of seeking justice for this. I know there are, as we know, there are roughly 1 million people, perhaps more, that were killed on these COVID protocols, these COVID death protocols, particularly under this Biden administration that has just engaged in such evil actions across the board in undermining our rights, our lives, our freedom, everything that we hold dear. America, this is why we are doing the Whistleblower Report. Please support our work with your gifts of financial support, sharing our message, help others to know the dangers, and make sure if you or a loved one is going into the hospital, they have got to have an advocate there with them. And you need very clear advanced directives refusing all of these medications that are being misused and overdosed and killing people. Major Gary, your comments in closing?
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Vliet. Last thing I would like to say about this is, through the outreach of the foundation, I've met great Americans like Leslie, and it's unfortunate under these circumstances, but I'm reminded of Matthew 24:12, which says, because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. And that's what's happened so bad for the last 3 years in this country.
You are absolutely right. And for our listeners to know, Major Gary is chairman of Medicine and Ministry for the Truth for Health Foundation. He's also chairing our Vaccine Injury Support Program. And we didn't talk a lot about that tonight. We do have legal action going forward on the hospital death protocols. And we do have legal action going forward on the COVID vaccine injuries, through some programs and types of legal strategies that were discussed in our legal symposium with Warner Mendenhall not long ago. It's on our Faith Over Fear archive on our website. So if you're interested in the creative legal approaches that Truth for Health Foundation is undertaking, you can listen to and watch that video program with Warner Mendenhall and some of the things we're doing. And we need your financial support to carry on these legal cases and to provide the legal grants to help people with these horrible situations and these devastating tragedies. So please join our crusade, sign up for our email alerts, join our Faith Over Fear community every Tuesday night, and donate to support our public charity. I work pro bono for the foundation. This is my mission in response to God's calling. We urge all of you to support our outreach, our efforts, and our legal defense program to help bring justice for the families that have been so horribly devastated by these tragic losses. Leslie, again, my heart goes out to you and your family and your son, and we will stay in contact, and we would like very much to have you be part of our outreach to others and help people know all the resources we've created to help them. Thank you for joining us on the Whistleblower Report, and may all of you hold your loved ones close and speak out against evil. Thank you for joining us tonight.